The family finance program.
Yeah, let's, maybe you can elaborate on that. That's okay.
Well, the family finance program nationally was started from support of the Life Insurance Institute, or the Institute of Life Insurance. I was in New York City. This is the agency for the provides literature and public service to the public on the field of life insurance, and life insurance companies belong to this and support it by paying X amount of a fee depending upon the size of their company. And I, at that time, may still be true, 90 to 95% of the insurance companies did subscribe and be a part of this agency that represented the industry. Well, they perceived the idea of setting up a national organization, a national committee on family finance. See, originally it was known as Family Financial Security Education, Family Financial Security Education. And so they had this national committee. Hunt, who had been superintendent of schools at Chicago, was the chairman of it. And so it operated, and they employed a person from the institute to be the administrative secretary of it. And the whole thing was funded from the institute, which in turn got their money from their life insurance companies.
Why did they want such an organization?
Well, let me go to this now. Okay. They were convinced, the people, the boards, and the insurance agent field, that teachers were not sufficiently well informed on financial security or family finance. And the whole idea of the program was to establish, initially, the University of Pennsylvania was the first one, and then subsequently there were Wisconsin and a couple others, one in Oregon, one in Texas. I think there were four for a couple years, and then it kept growing to be, finally it grew into, 35, 40 schools that were participating. But the program was primarily established to have on campus an institute or a workshop. We called ours a pro seminar. Dean Fowkes was very active in it. He was contacted. Dean Fowkes was contacted by people. He knew Hunt well, by the way, superintendent of schools in Chicago. And it was through that contact that he was, through his relationship with Hunt, that he became familiar with it and got interested and asked that the program be set up here. I was invited to serve as coordinator of the program here on this campus. I was always too busy in the summertime teaching my own courses in business education to become involved in the actual teaching, but I coordinated and got it organized. But they provided money so that we could select 40, I think it was something like 40 people, teachers, from various academic areas, but primarily they were from business and home economics and social studies. Those are the three disciplines at the secondary level that teach courses that might be related to family finance most. So we started in the summer of 52-53 with our first workshop, and the whole idea was to attempt to provide a program that teachers who were teaching these subjects would be better informed on family finance. Now that included investments and all the various we had. The program was designed here. Originally, it was an 8-week program, and they got 6 academic credits, and they were here for the whole 8 weeks. And We had several individuals from the school business that gave lectures dealing with investments, financial matters, wills, and how to, estate planning and all this. And the schools, the University of Pennsylvania that had had the program previously provided us with their syllabus, so we had that as a guide. And then we employed a person who was in the Department of Public Instruction to actually coordinate it during the summer and be here and be the active coordinator, because my work was too busy in the other areas, but I worked with it to get it set up and organized. University of Pennsylvania was considered the national headquarters for this program for several years. And so it was primarily a summer program. Well, it was entirely a summer program here. And we would meet then with the other, eventually, as I say, it grew, started out with two, three, or four, and each year they added several, and so eventually it came, and there must have been 25, 30 schools participating. I think the program now is expired. I don't think it's active anymore at all, and has been expired here since 67, was it? But during those years, the amount of money provided the university was several thousand dollars to offer some sort of a scholarship to attract the teacher here. It might be sufficient to pay the tuition or sufficient to pay the room and board. I think it was no large sum, but nevertheless it was something to be making it an attraction for them. And it wasn't too different than some of the programs that were developed federal funds in the science area, where the science teachers were brought back and given scholarships. And of course, in that program, there was far, far more money.
Right.
The source, the federal government, a little larger than the Family Finance Life Insurance Institute. But Carl Hall, when the University of Pennsylvania no longer wanted to carry on the national program, we were asked to assume that role. And for a couple of years, Professor Bauer in the School of Business handled it 1 year.
When you say we, primarily the School of Education?
Yeah, primarily School of Education, although there was a great cooperation from faculty in School of Business lecturing in the summer program, but the credit was given through the School of Education, through the Department of Education, as a matter of fact, and the administrative details were handled through the School of Education. But as I say, Jim Barr, Professor Barr, handled 1 year, and his son was the Open Golf Champion this summer. And another person then who was the director after we were the National Center was Stu North, who was here on the faculty and got his PhD, and since now has gone to Houston, University of Houston in Texas. And as we all know, Andy North, his son, is quite a well-known golfer. Well, then, after those two, we really needed someone who could devote full time year throughout the year. So, where you got that name? Oh, Carl Hall, from University of Oklahoma. And he had been involved, he just gotten his doctorate there, and he had been involved in their family finance program, and they had a very active one there, as we had here. And so Carl came to us with good background and was with us for a period of two or three years. When he left then for a better opportunity elsewhere, the program closed. At that time, the National Committee and the Institute of Life Insurance decided to close the National program, and I guess they decided it served its purpose, and so it expired pretty much with our closing in 1967. And I was associated with it throughout this period, but after Carl came, of course, he took over the active management, and so I was on the advisory committee that worked with him.
I think that a couple of the natural questions that might come to mind to somebody would be, well, did anyone ever, on the faculty here, for instance, ever challenge this program, say, in a matter of compromising academic freedom and that sort of thing, and compromising the position of the university? Did that ever come up?
Not really, and yet it's a question that was in the back of my mind many, many times. And I might say this, that while the money came from this national committee, which was really merely an offshoot of the institute and set up by the Institute of Life Insurance, they were very careful not to dictate what we were to teach or the program. They provided the funds and some general guidelines that were given. But
did they provide any teaching materials?
No. We provided our own teaching materials. We developed our own projects, and some of those that had been developed at other schools, at the University of Pennsylvania initially, for example, were used as guides. Now, it's true that we got materials from the Institute of Life Insurance that they provided generally to the public and to schools at all levels. But we were not dictated to as to that we must teach X amount of life insurance, because we've taught very broadly on the financial matters. And I think if they had attempted to, it wouldn't have lasted very long here. John Guy Fawkes, particularly as dean, was very strong in the belief that no outside interest should ever dictate to the university. But nevertheless, that kind of program can be subject to the very question you raise, as to whether this is proper kind of activity in which a university should participate. But I must say, throughout the period, no one ever challenged directly. It never really came up, but it was something that was in the back of my mind many, many times that people might. And it was a subject of discussion that as we got together from the various schools in our, we'd meet semi-annually, really, that we not be dictated to. I think most universities feel very strong that they want no outside pressures to exert influence on their curriculum. Mm. Obviously, this was to be in the area of family finance and not in the area of basket weaving or something else, you see. Mm.
Is it, probably is, coincidental that the year that the program ended here was, I think, the first year that Flynn Stiles was the dean? Is there any connection with that?
It ended the first year that Picardi was dean. It carried through, because I recall that the first year that that Don McCarty came to Wisconsin, he and I went. Now, it may, what year would that have been? Lynn Stiles came aboard in 55, and so...
McCarty comes in 66, I believe.
66, and the program ended in 67, that's right, yeah. You see. So that his first year here was the last year. We went to Chicago to a meeting, and that was my last meeting I attended. The program folded from that point on, or our participation folded.
Are you aware of anything that McCarty had to do with that, or was this, again, just a coincidence?
It's just a coincidence, yeah. No. And, of course, John Guy Fawkes got involved with it initially in 52, but then when he left and Lynn Stiles came along, Lynn was a supporter of the program. And this really, I don't know, things were done very informally in those days compared to the way they are today. It was pretty much set up through the dean's office originally. Obviously, the credit had to be approved through a department, but that didn't seem to present any problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're going to make, before we get going today, January 30th, 1979, a few additions and corrections to last week's discussion.
Yes, I'd like to give some more specific information with respect to two or three committees. First, perhaps of greatest significance and importance, is the committee appointed by Dean Foulkes, and which had been authorized by the School of Education in the spring of 1948 to study and make recommendations with respect to an undergraduate program in the preparation of business teachers. I had come here, as been indicated, with no undergraduate program, and it had been assumed when I was employed that an undergraduate program would be established. But Dean Foulkes established a committee consisting of these people: Professor Isom, who at the time was chairman of the Department of History, Dean Earl Gomnitz, who was the assistant dean of the School of Business at the time and later became dean, Merle Jensen, of the professor of the History Department, R. E. Langer, who was chairman of the mathematics department, and G. T. Trewartha, geography department, and Professor M. H. Willing of the Department of Education. And I was appointed as the chairman of the committee, and it was my job really to sell these people who represented the very important position campus-wide. And as indicated in the previous recording, we were very pleased that we were able to get this committee to see the necessity for a program in the preparation of business teachers, and the report was presented to the School of Education and approved April 1248, then later it went to the, later that spring, to the general faculty and was approved there. Well, that rather completes that identification. I had mentioned also in the previous recording some of my university-wide committee involvements, and again, I was not too well prepared and didn't have some specific dates, but just for the record, let me list that I was on the Graduate School Administrative Committee for a period of 6 years, 1962 to 68. I really replaced Professor Arvil Bahr, who had been on that committee for many, many years, but he was retired and did pass away in this early period. But I guess at that time, the graduate school did not have a policy of rotation, but they did have a policy of having representation from the various schools. And Arvil Bahr, for many years, represented the School of Education on that committee. And then it was felt that I might succeed him, and I was appointed by the dean and approved by the chancellor. I guess perhaps that time it was the president of the university. And so I did serve and represented the School of Education, and by the way, the School of Business had no representation on that committee either, so I served in sort of a dual capacity. Now, I was on the university committee for 1 year, filling out a term that one person had been elected for 3 years. And the policy, this is, people are elected to the university committee from the campus. It's a campus-wide election. And so people are nominated from various segments of the university, but there's no policy with respect to particular representation that there should be X number from the LNS or X number from other colleges. But so people are nominated and are elected, and this the university committee, consisting of six people who serve for three-year terms, and there are two elected each year, is really the executive committee for this campus, the University of Wisconsin, now Madison, but previously University of Wisconsin, period. And it is the most powerful of all committees. And frequently in the newspapers, you'll see the all-powerful university committee thus and so. Well, if for any reason a member who is elected cannot complete his term, then they go back to the election and pick up the next person the highest number of votes. So the year that I was a nominee, the two people elected had a higher number of votes, but I was third, and so when the vacancy came up, I was asked to serve this final and third year. And it was a very interesting period, but because the university committee in 1969 and 70 was really the high point of the protests on the campus, and there's tremendous number of riots and all kinds of confrontations, and so it was a very interesting period. The chancellor would come to our committee with problems that he had as a result of the riots and the other disturbances. All we could do really, though, is to make recommendations and to use the influence of this executive committee of mm-hmm. the faculty, so to speak, in making...
Can you give a specific example when you can...
No, I guess I can't. That resulted in any particular action. I know that there were several occasions when, and I would have to go back, and I don't have my memory fresh to identify specificities of activities, but I know that there are certain actions that the chancellor was taking, the university was taking at that time, in trying to meet the protests of the students. But I guess I am so vague that I cannot identify that. I guess perhaps one, it's interesting, at that particular time, Mr. Rowan, who is now a candidate to be the mayor of Madison now in 1979, was one of the individuals who wrote extensively in the student Cardinal and supporting the protest group. Mm-hmm. As you know, he's McGovern's son-in-law and was very active in that. But I guess I can't point, and someone would have to do some research on this, have to point to any particular thing, any action that we took. I guess I should mention, really though, the thing that evolved that year that became of greatest significance was the university, the reorganization of the university from the general faculty meetings into a senate. And that year, our committee was asked to prepare the framework for the organization that we now have. As you know, up until this time, all university business was conducted by the university faculty meeting in session once a month, and faculty were invited, all faculty members, legal faculty members, to come and participate. But as a matter of fact, most people chose not to come and participate, excepting those who may have something that they want to present. The only time that we really had large groups would be if a salary question or something in relation to parking or something else, that it would hit the personal life of the individual faculty member. But as the faculty grew, the difficulty of having good representation through this hit-and-miss representation of individual people seemed to be need improvement. So it was perceived that we'd have a Senate that would establish, that would be elected by each of the various segments of the university. And that, of course, is a matter of record, how it was set up and all. But this would be the most significant thing that we were involved in that year with respect to something that can be identified.
Well, something related to this, if I may. Going back to that year and those years where there was a lot of disorder on campus, maybe you can discuss briefly what the reaction of the School of Education faculty was to this, some individuals that you might know in terms of how they looked upon it and how that was dealt with in classes and that kind of thing. As I know, for instance, during the TA strike, you know, there was a matter of boycotting classes and so on and so forth.
Well, I guess I can't really, after all, this was a phase of our life. As we look back now, we just can't believe that the protest group that took place in the 60s could ever have happened, and that we would have the National Guard standing at the entrances to the buildings and checking identification, and it's just unbelievable. Now, how did the School of Education, I suppose pretty much like the entire university, I know that there was a great movement to have student representation in the departmental meetings and in the committees, and as a matter of fact, that at that time provision was made so that students could be, that was one of their claims, or one of their one of the what shall I say, one of the, I can't identify the word I want to pull out, but one of the things, if I can use the word things, that the students were protesting about was their lack of participation in curriculum development and the affairs of the departments. And I know that in the School of Education we did follow through by identifying people. I do know in all committees it was a tremendous task, but I do also know that in many instances, after the first few meetings, many of these people found that they had too many other activities, and this sort of fell by the wayside. I guess I can't respond more to your question than that. Let me just also, while I'm trying to fill in this vacancy with more specific information, after the university committee in 69-70, then I was nominated and elected to the Social Studies Divisional Committee, and of course it's a matter of record on this campus that there are four divisions, and the Social Studies Division has representation, the School of Education, School of Business, many departments in L&S and in agriculture. And I was elected in 70, and Glenn I from the School of Education was also elected at the same time, so we served jointly for a three-year period. And the third year, I was elected chairman, which meant handling a lot of administrative detail for the divisional committee. The divisional committee, is really very significant and important in the lives of the faculty of the university, because all matters of curriculum, all matters of tenure positions must clear through the divisional committees. And they clear, and then they go as a recommendation to the dean, which he can accept or reject, but almost always he accepts, because to reject would be put him in an indefensible position. I also mentioned just vaguely, in going back to my own personal professional life, some dates the last time that in the previous recording, but let it be a matter of record that my first opportunity to serve in an administrative position in a professional organization was our Ohio Business Teacher, where I spent my first 15 years as a high school business teacher, 1937 and 38. In 1955, I was served as president of the National Business Teachers Association. I had been treasurer of that organization, been on the board in many other positions. My next position was 1959-61. I was president of the National Association of Business Teacher Education. And this organization is a membership to that is by institution, and the University of Wisconsin School of Education had an institutional membership in this, and all the schools preparing business teachers in the country would have representation, or would like very much, and I think all did. And the last one, I was president of the National Business Education Association in 1968. and connected with the NABTE, there was this organization known as the Associated Organization for Teacher Education. This was a national organization established to have representation from various disciplines, business education, one discipline, math, all the physical education, all those involved in teacher education. Mm-hmm. And each organization was asked to elect two people to serve on this council, and for 3-year terms, and it was up to the cooperating professional organization to identify the people who would serve the AOTE. Now, this AOTE was, the parent organization was the AACTE, the American Association of Colleges of Teacher Education, which originally was an organization entirely operated by deans of the various colleges of teacher education. But in more recent years, it's become other people, that is, professors, faculty members have been elected to that. But by being on the AOTE, there was the AACT had established the AOTE and had sort of a parent relationship. And from the AOTE, one person was elected each year to serve on the executive committee of AACTE. And for a 3-year period, I served in that capacity. Parallel, at the same time, the Dean Stiles, who was on the AACT, so he was there through the normal route of being elected, and I was there by the fact that I was representing AOTE and really business education on this very important national committee, and they still have executive. At one time, they were closely related with the National Education Association, but that. In recent years, they separated and independent, no longer related to the National Education Association. Well, those are some of the specific dates I wanted to get have recorded.
I think perhaps next it would be nice to move on to discussing the time when you were the chairman of the Department of Education, which I believe was from the years 1955 through 1959.
4-year period, yes. At that time, it should be recorded that the Department of Education was the only department in the School of Education dealing with professional education. That is, all matters of professional education were handled by the Department of Education. I had indicated the last time that there was a department known as Educational Methods, and when I was employed in 1945 and came in the summer of 46, the Department of Educational Methods was really employed by the chairman of that department, Ira Davis, but when I arrived, that department no longer existed because it had been, it was operating in its last year of existence. So beginning in 1946, the time that I arrived, I never served in the Department of Educational Method because it had merged with the Department of Education. And so beginning in 46, then I had been a member of the Department of the Department of Education. I had served in that department by being the secretary, taking minutes, but beyond that, I never could quite identify why I was elected in 55 because I had I'd been on campus 8 or 9 years, but had sort of a remote position identification as far as the mainstream of administrative activities of the department. I should indicate
who nominated you.
Mayburn?
Who nominated you?
Well, I'm just going to suggest that John Mayer, who had been the chairman for a few years, a professor in mathematics, was serving as acting dean in the year 54-55, his first year, and Leroy Peterson, who was a professor in ed administration, he had worked in the extension too, and Leroy had been elected to serve as the chairman of the Department of Education John Mayer was acting dean. This is acting dean after John Guy Fawkes had resigned to take an assignment in India along with Cliff Little. Well, one day I happened to see John. I knew John well because he had educational methods, and then methods of math, and I had methods in business ed. So we had some common activities. But John said, "I just received a letter from Gladys Borchers." Now Gladys Borchers was a professor in speech education, and she was at Wisconsin High and also active in the speech department. And Gladys was on leave that year, and John said, "I just received a letter from Gladys," and she said, "You know, I think Russ Hosler would make a good chairman, Department of Education." I said, that thought never occurred to me. And it never did. I saw no reason why. I had no prior experience for it. So that, and then Milt Powell. John became supportive of the idea, and I think he and Milt felt that maybe, now Leroy Peterson had only, he was serving his first year at that time, and as far as I knew, he was doing a very satisfactory job, but I think some of the people, and apparently in the educational methods area, where I had worked, of mm-hmm. course, knew the faculty best, felt that our area hadn't been represented in the chairmanship for some years. I don't know. People are nominated by a department by anybody wishing to nominate somebody. And so at the session when people were nominated, my name, I guess I said when I was asked, I'm complimented, but I don't think I would have any chance of being elected. But if you want to nominate me, yes, I'll be with you. And that's the way it happened then. And for some reason or other, Mr. Peterson, I don't think it was really in protest to what Mr. Peterson's work, Professor Peterson's work was doing, so much as they some of these people became very, carried on a very active campaign. Certainly I didn't. I wasn't involved in any way with it. To have me elected, and I guess the vote, as I recall, was pretty close, maybe. So that's the way I became chairman of the Department of Education, and it's interesting that I became chairman and started in the fall of 1955, the precise time that Dean Stiles was assuming the role as dean. It's been a period of a year that John Mayer was serving as an acting capacity, and he had been a candidate to be the dean of the School of Education, but was not elected. And so Dean Stiles, who came from being dean of the University of Virginia, came aboard same time that I came aboard as chairman, so we worked very closely together for many, many years. And I think that I was elected each year, rather unanimously. Once a person finds somebody that's willing to carry on as chairman of a department, it seems he can be easily reelected because it is an awesome responsibility and a very arduous task to carry on all the work of the chairmanship of the department. And but each of the years, I was nominated and elected without any competition. No one ever wanted to challenge it because they were content, I guess, with the work I was doing. And I was quite willing to end my experiences, which were great, but I felt that after a period of time I'd had sufficient. At the end of the third year, but I was persuaded to continue for one more year, which I did, and I made it perfectly clear that I would not stand for election because it took too much time and effort away from the thing that brought me here, namely my own discipline of business education. And then at that time, Dean, you don't really get elected by your colleagues, your peers. It's a preferential vote which goes to the dean. And the dean then officially appoints the the chairman, but obviously he's very much influenced by this preferential vote, and then must be approved by the chancellor or the superior officer on campus. And so there were several things that evolved during my tenure. One was that in 1957, suddenly through the cooperative education program in the U.S. office, there's money that became available for research for the first time. Dean Stiles had been one to greatly push for having research money available in education. And he would frequently refer to the tremendous amount of research money that's used in Wisconsin to improve the cows, but practically no research money to improve education in the kids of Wisconsin. And this is true. When I became chairman of the department, there were no people really on the budget for research, excepting Bert Kreitlow had a fourth of his position identified when he was brought here as research. So he was budgeted one-fourth in research. He was the only person at that time that had any research. Now, all of us, all faculty members, it's assumed that a part of your work is going to be carrying on research in your field. But to be able to have money and your salary partially or totally paid mm-hmm. from research funds was unheard of in education at that time, but very extensive in agriculture and many of the other disciplines on campus.
May I interject something? Would you, just as a comment, would you say that the faculty in the early 50s were expected to carry heavier teaching loads and not do quite as much research as they are now?
Much so. It was at that time there was a very clear understanding that all faculty members would teach 9 credit hours, and this was pretty religiously carried out. And then, in addition, above that, one would be expected to carry on certain research and obviously have a publication program. Just to carry forward in this 1957, when this Cooperative Education Act became available, Dean Stiles had been active in the affairs of getting this established in Washington. And so instantly, he was anxious for several of our people in the School of Education to apply for funds. And this came in the middle of the year. And Klossmeyer was one person involved, Kai Jensen was another. And there were three or four. But suddenly, here we always had our neat 9 credit hours for every faculty members. Now it's all being broken up, people are not all teaching 9 credits. Some are teaching only 6, 3, or perhaps none at all. And then the difficulty finding faculty, and that was a tremendous task that we had to find people who could take over these classes. And so beginning at that point in history and continuing on today, a great number of faculty members, and this is of course one of the explanations for the great growth and the numbers of faculty then as compared to now was very small. But today we have a much larger number of faculty, many of them on so-called soft money, others on soft money, but also part of regular tenure track on the university appointment system. But when these research funds became available in 57, it opened the doors to much greater, and that's a phenomenal development on the amount of research money that become available from many sources, foundations as well as the national government, to carry on research in the School of Education. Of course, our Research and Development Center came along in due time as an outgrowth of this early rate. But this was what really got the research program started, was this original co-op program in the Department of Education, in the Washington. And as I mentioned earlier, Dean Stiles has been one of those who was very active in promoting the idea of this, of these funds. Mm-hmm. They were, compared to today, they were small, but still they were very significant for the sort of a seed corn start.
Okay. In the few years before you, or right after this availability of federal money, did you notice that there was a different emphasis on the qualities which incoming faculty were expected to have in comparison to the years before? Did the federal money influence the way faculty were judged on the basis they're coming to Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think there's no question that research and the significance of research became more prominent in the criteria used for evaluation. Certainly research had always been there as one, but I think the greater emphasis and attention was given to it. And I might, here's another, I don't know whether this has come up previously or not, but at about this time, through Dean Stiles' leadership and rather using a crusade, the School of Education became a member of the divisional system. Up until this time, has this been come? Up until this time, the university had the School of Education was not a part of the divisional system. Now, all in 1979, all departments in the university must belong to a division. But at that time, it was optional for some of the professional colleges, and the School of Education did not go through the divisional committee for its tenure appointments, and instead it went to administrative committee that the dean had established. And so when it was moved that the Department of Education would be a part of the divisional committee and social studies divisional committee, then all of our appointments had to go through that, tenure appointments. And I think this had great impact on the emphasis given to research and the when people being employed as assistant professors at down the track when they, down the road when they would want to make application or their turn would come or they'd completed the 3 or 6 years necessary to be an applicant for tenure, I think they would realize that greater attention would be given to research activity than had been true previously through this administrative committee, which was a screening committee, but did not give the close attention or the significance, or did not weight, I would say, research. And one of the problems has been, I think, in the divisional committee now, is that they often, the largest percentage of the individuals on the divisional committee are from other areas, whereas a professional school like the School of Education, there are some things different in the evaluation of the individual. That is, the individual who is in the School of Education and doing a lot of field work does not have the time to do the laboratory, the research that can be carried on in the laboratory in one of the science labs on campus. And so the number of people who move in the School of Education up the ladder and receive tenure today, percentage is, I would say, much more than was true in an earlier period prior to our being accepted or become membership in the Social Studies Divisional Committee. And I think maybe there are other factors. I think maybe university-wide the tightening of requirements has been significant during this period.
Well, let me pursue this divisional committee a little bit. I was not aware of this. The School of Education at that point in the late 50s, you mentioned, is when they entered the divisional committee membership.
Well, it was either 57 or 58.
Okay. Was this done on a voluntary basis? I mean, you weren't required to by university rule or something?
We were not required at that time. Okay. It was done voluntarily by the School of Education, but under the, I think, the motivation provided by the Dean Stiles, who felt that we were really had a little stigma attached to us because we didn't belong to the divisional committee.
Mm-hmm. Now, I assume that the faculty had to approve that move.
That's right.
Was there considerable unanimity about it? Or
well, there's obviously some question raised, and of course people who were already tenured would be making the decision, and so they were not going to be any retroactive action on those who are now tenured. It'd only be those in the future. And I think most of us felt that perhaps to belong to the divisional committee would give the School of Education greater status and recognition across the campus than by being operating as in isolation from it. And of course, we've always, the School of Education has always had the battle to fight of recognition and status from other segments of the university, and this isn't only true here, but everywhere.
Do you believe that the move did, in fact, improve
I'm
your
sure
status?
I'm sure it improved quality of people being employed with respect to their background and quantitative research methodology. I'm sure of that. I'm also sure that that there have been problems, and I guess the time, maybe this is not the place, maybe you may want to pick it up somewhere else, but I also feel that at times it would be desirable to have a professional, a divisional committee made up of the professional schools that give greater consideration to professional activities of faculty members outside the campus then, and give weight to that, then is true under the present system, because the criteria you use in the present system is pretty much that which is done used by the person doing research in a laboratory on campus and writing for the scientific journals. People who are not involved in professional activities and teacher education as we are.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a problem. And I think the number of people who have been given tenure from the School of Education in recent years is very small, and the number that have been denied by the divisional committee is very high. I might say in my own case, the person that had been selected by the committee, I had recommended that someone who would be employed with a tenure position, that someone should be employed who was a senior, would be a senior faculty to carry on. And that was accepted. And so the search and screen committee started looking for individuals, and they found someone that they felt was very good and would meet the criteria, and of course, because they wanted to employ this individual as a tenure faculty, it went to the divisional committee, it was turned down, and so they
felt...
What
was the basis?
Well, it just did not meet the standards of publication, research and publication, although the list was long. Someone attempted to make an evaluation of those publications that didn't meet the what that committee at that time felt was necessary. Well, the committee had searched the country and felt they had done the best they could at that level, so then they decided to employ someone as an assistant professor who would not be seeking tenure immediately, but would be on this campus, have the opportunity to build the background necessary to meet that within the six-year period, I guess it is now.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, that the co-op education during the period that I was chairman of the Department of Education, another very important development was the change from the student teaching arrangement that we had. Whereby most of it was done at Wisconsin High School. Wisconsin High School had the existence since about 1914 to the present to that time. Actually, it 1964 was the last year of its existence. But it was felt by the leadership, Dean Stiles, and many other people that we really ought to, our kids who are preparing to become teachers ought to have that laboratory experience on a school that would be more likely the type of school that they would have when they would seek employment. Mm-hmm. Wisconsin High School was a school serving, well, anyone with small tuition, I guess it's $50 a year was ridiculously small. But a large number of people from Maple Bluff and Shorewood, areas with high population income professional groups, sending the because it didn't have high schools at that time, that was before those areas were part of the Madison system. And so Wisconsin High was open to anyone that make application and pay the $50, but these people coming in from Shorewood and Maple Bluff, their local municipality paid this small insignificant tuition of $50, and so the university was really, the state was really educating these people, providing a high school, so to speak, for areas where, as I say, the income and financial status would be such that they could, well, they mm-hmm. just weren't paying their share of the load. But so for that reason and others, it was felt that that was not a good situation. The only really strong thing that you can say about a laboratory school is that the university has control of it and can do experimentation and carry on that kind of work that is helpful. But in 1957, again a point that Dean Stiles exerted considerable leadership, and I as chairman of the department, and I also as professor in the department, professor of business education, was interested in getting our kids out of the laboratory school where they would teach. In those days, the common experience was to go to Wisconsin High School and teach one class, be participating in one class a semester, and then that'd be a part of the university system. But often there would be three or four student teachers in the same class. And so the idea of developing a block came about in the School of Education. As a matter of fact, legislation was passed someplace along the line that the student teaching, that this block was officially established, whereby the students would go out for 7 weeks full time. And then the remaining 7 weeks or 8 weeks would be on campus picking up blocks, taking up methods and professional courses and so forth. Now,
was this modeled on some other school's experience or something?
Well, I think there were other schools developing the block. I can't identify any particular one at the time. Much of it was modeled after, I think, what sort of evolved at the time. I think we weren't the only one. Countrywide, the feeling was developing, mm-hmm. the consensus that laboratory experiences needed to be more full-time. And so the difficulty with the framework, now at that time we had 18 credits in professional education. There were twelve of those in professional courses. There were three foundational courses, three credits each, that's nine, and then there were two credits given in student teaching in one of them, so that's 11 credits of the 18. And so the remaining seven credits were given in two methods, four credits, and then there was student teaching, seven credits. In the major methods, you take methods of teaching math, for example, two credits, and then there'd be three more added on, so you had five credits. That included the student teaching in math, but the the credit, the student teaching we'd done at Wisconsin High. In connection with Ed 75, one of the foundational courses, that course was five credits, three for the course and two for the student teaching in the minor or at least in one other area. And so we really had five credits, three that was in the major and two with 75. We had five credits available for student teaching. Well, we needed more than that. If you're going to put people out in a seven-week block, certainly a minimum ought to be seven credits. And one consideration was that we would go to the faculty and ask for an increase in the number of credits that we could give it in professional education. 18 had been the ceiling before, up to this time, and for some years later, for that matter. And so Dean Stiles did some exploring, and other faculty members did too, with other individuals on campus. And the consensus was developing that this was sort of a low point in the status of professional education countrywide. There were a lot of articles on too much emphasis on professional courses and the preparation of teachers, not enough on the subject matter. And it soon became clear that the faculty at that time, 1956, 7, 8, along there, would not be receptive to the idea of increasing the number of professional credits.
I mean the university faculty?
The university faculty, because that's where where it would have to go for final approval. And so
the School of Education faculty was, however.
Oh, yes. I think there had been no difficulty getting it approved there. So it was decided instead that we'd have to work within the 18 credits. And how you're going to increase the student teaching from five credits to seven, which we needed, and we had established seven as being the minimum desirable number of weeks for student teaching. So the nine credits in the required undergraduate basic courses, foundational courses, by considerable persuasion by the dean and a few other individuals, that those nine credits would be reduced to seven, and so that the student would take Education 73 for 2 to 3 credits, 74 2 to 3, and 75 2 to 3. But what really developed was that one of them would be for 3 and the other for 2 credits, and that thereby the 2 additional credits then was added to the 5 credits that had been available for student teaching. So suddenly now we have 7 credits, but we're still operating within the framework of 18 credits.
Mm-hmm.
And now in recent years that has been for reasons, certain other requirements have been added from outside groups, such as DPI requiring the reading and, of course, the human relations and so forth. That's been considerably increased. But at that time, it was a revolutionary idea, really, to increase the student teaching from the 5 to 7, and we did it by taking away from these foundational courses. And initially, the business ed division, and we had a pretty good enrollment in those days, and the home economics were the two. Before this program was officially set up, we had sufficient flexibility within our program that we, of other courses, we could control credits. And so the home economics and business education experimented and were the first on campus to have their student teachers go out for the 7-week block.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the 7-week block was on campus for 5 weeks, and then off campus for 7 weeks, that was 12, then we'd be back on campus for 3 weeks. And I was always very enthusiastic about the program. I felt it worked well in business education. There are some who would argue that even 7 weeks is not enough. There ought to be a full semester for student teaching. And I always responded, yes, that's good. Even a whole year would be good. But when you have certain choices one has to make between professional courses and the subject matter preparation, I think the 18 credits and the 7 credits for student teaching as it was evolved and set up at that time did a very accurate job. Now, shortly thereafter, when the block plan got going, then the internship program was established. This was about 1960. You perhaps have that in your records. And then that changed somewhat the program. Actually, the number of credits didn't change a great deal. I think maybe where until getting 7, they got 8. But of course, going out as an intern, that was an entirely different kind of experience, and they were there for the full semester and got paid.
Right. Now, from what I've been able to gather from looking at department minutes and that sort of thing, the block teaching proposals within the School of Education among the faculty were rather widely debated.
Well, there was considerable debate, yes.
Now, what were those areas of debate revolving around? Is that something I don't know about?
Yeah. Well, I think obviously the people who were teaching these foundational courses, 73, 74, and 75, felt that they had a body of content that should be given to all students, and to reduce that would be injurious to the development of the program and to the individual. So they were something less than enthusiastic about this taking from theirs. I guess I'm not familiar with really the thing that caused the greatest development was discussion. Was this mere fact, how we're going to get this additional credit? I think there was general acceptance of the idea of the seven-week block that was developed by a committee within the Department of Education, and I was very much involved with that. And I have no recollection of any great opposition to this program. I think it was universally accepted as a wonderful step, because compared to this one class a day at Wisconsin High School. But there was a great deal of discussion. How are we going to get the increase in number of credits? And I've just outlined how that was done.
Mm-hmm.
But it took. Finally, the persuasion came directly from Dean Stiles, who came to the various divisions and was able, through his persuasion, to convince the faculty that this was the direction we should go.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, remember, in those days, the Department of Education was the only department dealing with this matter. Today, it's split up into innumerable departments, and it would be much, much more difficult to carry on. And incidentally, today, we do no longer have a single block program that everyone must take, as you know, of course.
A couple things more that I think went on while you were chairman in regard to teacher training here. One thing that I came across was that in 1959, John Guy Fawkes put forward what he called a proposal to establish a program to improve local schools and teacher preparation in Wisconsin in conjunction with the Ford Foundation. I think this is what's known as the Wisconsin Improvement Program.
That's right.
Can you detail a little bit about how that arrived and the reaction of the faculty to it and so on and so forth, and what impact that's had?
Well, the Wisconsin Improvement Program established in 1959 with funds that John Guy Fawkes, secured. He came back from India, and John Guy would not be content to be a teaching professor in the department. He did for 1 year, and I think he looked around how funds could be secured to carry on special experimental work, and he was able to, he and he alone, with the support, of course, of Dean Stiles, was secured this money. I've forgotten the amount, several million dollars over a period of 5 years, I believe, for experimentation, calling the Wisconsin Improvement Program. And initially, that was not internship developed as one aspect of that, but the department was very receptive to it. Former Dean Fawkes was the director of the program. He got the money, so it was easy to for him to obviously be the one to carry on the program. And the faculty were very cooperative, because suddenly now we had money that could be secured.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, I had been trying for some time to receive money as a professor in business education for this experimentation multi-channel dictation. And we had our proposal established for a year or two preceding. At 58 was a little depression, drop in the financial condition of the country, and monies were quite tight, and we had gone to some sources and outside the university and were unable. But nevertheless, we had the proposal. So when this Wisconsin Improvement Program was established under the leadership of John Guy, and you'd have to say that he was instrumental in getting it established, we were there with a program that had been established. I mean, with a program that we had outlined, developed. Alan Lensing and myself, primarily in business education. So through, this is just one example. We were able then to get have funds to get the equipment needed, which we carried on at the East High School, which I mentioned, I think, in the last recording, and at Washington High School in Racine. And then there were a variety of perhaps you've already identified those, but a variety of activities that were initiated. But the one that evolved, of course, of greatest significance was the internship program. And eventually that grew to be the activity of the Wisconsin Improvement Program. Originally, it was not perceived, as I understand, as I recall, to be that possibility to be just one of the activities. After, I think, maybe two or three years, Wisconsin Improvement Program and the internship were rather synonymous.
Mm-hmm. Now, why the internship? Because why not simply extended black teaching, or why this sort of arrangement?
There was considerable discussion and debate among the faculty on this very point, and some felt that some faculty members I'm not prepared to identify, but John Guy Fawkes was a leader in this, but some felt under the leadership of John Guy Fawkes, the idea of people going out and being a part of the faculty for a full semester, one, and two, people who would get compensation comparable to what a beginning teacher would get teaching for one semester, would make this person a better qualified teacher, because he would be on his own, he would be meeting the requirements of the faculty within that school, whereas on student teaching, you're working with a co-op teacher. You're not really in control of your class. You're working with under the direction, close direction of a cooperative teacher, and so this was a position that was given, and certainly had a lot of merit. I used the internship program, my own activity in my own division, business education, primarily for people who were in special master's programs getting certified. They would we would place them in internship, because the undergraduate program was so established that it didn't provide the flexibility whereby they could go out for a whole semester unless they wanted to do it beyond their 4 years of normal requirements. And so, but in some areas they were in elementary education, and of course, as you know, this is now a university, a statewide program, and in some schools I think the people who have the higher credentials are the ones who are placed in the internship, and those with somewhat lower credentials are in a more traditional student teaching. But I guess the idea was presented, certainly there was no hard data or research that gave hard data on the superiority of one over the other. Now, with the student teaching, I felt that it did have some aspects of superior to the other. First place, it didn't take such a hunk of time out of the student's program. And the way we operated it, the fact they were on campus 5 weeks and taking their methods and just prior to going out, we would have them go out some so that they would have some identification of their class that they're going to be working with in the 7 weeks. And then when they did go, they would be working with several different subjects, four different subjects. In the internship, often, you would teach two classes. Sometimes it'd be two classes of the same subject. You would not have the breadth where the student teaching the short period, but they had, in our case, and this is true, I'm sure, in many others, they would have experience in four different subject areas. In our case, it would be typewriting, shorthand, bookkeeping, and basic business. Now, these are all four rather distinctive courses that I felt was important for our people to have experience in their student teaching. Now, if they were being on an internship, they probably would have two of those only because of the arrangement of being a full-time teacher. I think, as I recall, they were teaching normally two or three classes. But then when our people came back and spent the 3 weeks on campus afterwards, we would have seminars and we would have discussion on what each one did and the problems arose, and we had a definite outline that we followed. And I felt this was a tremendous experience. And secondly, the people were involved in preparing a handbook of their experiences in each of the areas, dealing with taking a subject and listing the teaching methods used, the teaching problems, the testing, the evaluation. And all this was written up in a handbook that each person was required to complete. Mm-hmm. Now, in the internship, they're out there for the full semester. None of this was possible. And none of it could be done, at least as we operated it. Now, I don't know today what the division is. As you know, Madison was very active in the internship program initially, but a few years ago, the Madison Teachers Association ruled that internships would be not permitted within the Madison system because they were siphoning off monies that could be used to employ more teachers full-time in the regular programs.
From my brief experience here in the School of Education a few years ago, there were times when people would come back from the internship program sometimes with horror stories about how they've been used and would have to carry tremendous numbers of classes and that sort of thing with relatively little supervision. Can you sort of detail, has there been some sort of change in that way, that is, I assume that that's not the usual experience or that was not the way it was planned begin with?
I guess I guess I'm not too sensitive to these situations where they were terribly overloaded. I am sensitive to the fact that often they were not supervised, that they were given, these were their classes, just like any other teacher was employed, and the supervision was quite superficial. But I suspect, certainly not within any of my experiences, would this be true, that the claim could be made that the person was being used by... Mm-hmm. for a lot of cheap teaching to handle a large segment of classes. I suspect there were many situations where the least desirable classes were given to the interns, regardless of where this was the kind of experience that would be best in their mm-hmm. in their development program for to become a teacher. But I don't know. I guess you'd have to talk with someone that worked with the program more specifically.
Well, one last question, I don't know if you can answer or not, but was there any way or means by which this internship program was to be evaluated in terms of its success in improving the teachers of Wisconsin. For instance, you might just look at the percentage of people who dropped out of the teaching field or decided not to go into teaching as a result of their experience in block teaching versus internship. I mean, many people often decide after their teaching experience not to go into it. Was it ever evaluated in any way to determine the effectiveness of it?
Perhaps so, but not to my knowledge. I do not know of any study, and these kinds of studies or data collected from these kinds of studies, pretty hard to evaluate, and because you're dealing with human beings and there's so many variables involved that it's just not simple to make a study saying the 7-week block is inferior to the full semester for these reasons, because there may be some other factors that can't be. The researcher in the physical science lab can control the variables and then can come up with reasonable confidence statements, but when you're dealing with something so nebulous as all the factors involved to make a successful teacher, it's most of the decisions have been based upon judgment of individuals who presumably have a good deal of experience and knowledge in the field, and these that look to be good. And you could take an internship program that would be excellent. You could take others that you just referred to, where a teacher could be turned off. This prospective teacher going out and having a very bad internship experience could be turned off from the possibility of teaching, because this was not at all typical of what would be expected when you are a full-time teacher. And I suspect there are many situations where people did have a horror experience as an intern and decided this was not for me. Whereas if it had been under a more controlled situation in the block student teaching program, a more favorable interpretation or a more favorable reaction would have been made. You see, when you secure approval or permission to use a cooperating teacher, you've got the whole curriculum before you. To make that selection, you can get the very best. When you are selecting classes that are available for an internship, it's an entirely different story. And I suspect for that reason, often some experiences in student have blocked in the internship would have been weak in comparison to the other program. Mm-hmm. So I think one could list a lot of advantages and disadvantages. John Guy Fawkes, may I say, is always very adamant in his position that anybody that opposed the internship was not a very progressive individual in teacher education. So we used to have some lively discussions.
There was one other program that I was aware of that I believe started while you were department chairman, and that was, there was an experimental program by a special arrangement with the Department of Public Instruction that ran for 3 years in the latter part of the 50s, maybe into the early 60s. It was a response to, I believe, something that you mentioned earlier, that is that a lot of outside sources had attacked schools of education for putting too much emphasis on the professional and not enough on the academic. And there was an experimental program run for 3 years, I think, as a result. Do you know about that program? And
was this where the liberal arts program, where a person could become certified after completing a bachelor's degree in the liberal arts?
Right.
And then build upon this a combination spatial master's degree. Yes.
That's correct.
And this was established and carried on. I don't think it really terminated in 3 years. I just think they pushed with during a period of X number. But this became very popular in many schools during, I would say, the 50s, where there's a great demand for teachers who had more solid subject matter preparation, and meeting this claim that too many teachers spend too much time in learning how to do things and not knowing things to do. Mm-hmm. To do.
How did the faculty react to this program?
I think with very favorable, because we did get some people, high quality people, who high quality meaning people with good academic backgrounds, and the program was simply this: that the person would come with an academic background, let's say it could be in any discipline, take math for example, who had graduated from a math program in the liberal arts program, and then would be admitted, assuming that he had, to the graduate school, mm-hmm. and with deficiencies of 7 credits. And these deficiencies of 7 credits, no, I'm sorry, deficiencies of 9 credits, 9 credits. 7 credits for student teaching, and 2 credits for methods, major methods. But all the other professional courses that would normally be taken as an undergraduate in the undergraduate program would be taken for graduate credit. Mm. So that of the 18 credits necessary for certification, the 5, the 7, 9. So of the 18 credits, 9 of them would be graduate credits, and to meet then the 24 credits or whatever was necessary for the master's degree, the people would then pick up and additional credits in their subject area, maybe additional credits in education, and would complete then jointly 2 degrees, the certification program, 1, and 2, the master's degree. I had several people that, and this was very extensively advertised around over the country, and this kind of got involved with the internship program too. It seems to me that the internship program became kind of a hitchhike on this spatial master's. The spatial master's program, you mentioned it ran for 3 years. I wasn't aware of this, but I think it evolved into people who would be in this category of bachelor's degree from a liberal arts school. Now, when we say liberal arts, it might be from a program in business, it might be a program in economics or someone, but they would have their bachelor's degree in an academic subject area, or a subject area where it's academic, so-called. And that met a real need, and I'm not aware if that's still available. As far as I know, it was still available. I think I have no memory of it being eliminated. Okay. Completely. It just kind of phased out from last. Uh-huh. I might talk a little bit about the organization of the School of Education. The Department of Educational Psychology, during the latter years of my chairmanship, were reporting that they were having difficulty of getting proper recognition nationally in their professional meetings, because they were professors of education and not professors of psychology. You're a professor of a department that carries the name, you know. Mm-hmm. And so they felt, one, that for status recognition of their professional organization, that they needed to be able to have the title professor of psychology. Two, they felt if they were separate, they would have an opportunity to grow, because they would have their own budget and they would be able to make their own program and not have to be approved by a department that had a mix of many different areas and disciplines. And so ed psychology was really, and may I say that Dean Stiles at that time was also very supportive of the idea of increasing the number of departments. He felt that by taking the whole and dividing it into many parts, you're going to have much more in the way of budget. You'd be able to, just the clerical help would greatly be increased because there'd be that many more administrative units, and therefore serve the department better. Individuals, whether it would be in ed psychology or ed administration or whatever activity, would be able to concentrate more on their own thrust.